Welcome to FW Presents, the anthology show of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm Paul Ken, and I am joined tonight by two network all-stars, the irredeemable Shag and Siskoid. Hey, guys.
Hey, I'm an all-star. That's exciting.
We're all-stars.
We are here tonight to discuss the independent comic series The Maze Agency from the late 1980s and the 90s. Created by Mike W. Barr and illustrated by a young Adam Hughes, it was a true whodunit mystery series. Fear not, listeners. We will not spoil the mysteries, although we will talk about the subplots and relationship developments among the main characters. So, Shag, can you tell us why The Maze Agency?
Because it's a damn good comic, Paul. Why not? So, folks, this is a special, what we call Patreon-fueled episode. The whole idea to cover this came to us from one of our patrons, a gentleman named Michael Crouch. So Michael came to us and suggested covering Maze Agency as a fun episode. We thought, that's a fantastic idea. And then Paul made the foolish suggestion of offering to play General Cat Wrangler and get this thing together. And Siskoid and I have made it very difficult for him. So it's been very exciting, and I'm thrilled that Michael suggested this. It's been a great idea. And folks, overall, in case you don't know, the network itself is sponsored in part by Patreon, because, you know, running the network with so many shows requires a whole lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized that we needed some help with the expenses, so we launched a Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help us keep the network going. And people like Michael have stepped up at certain tiers. Because of that, they get certain benefits, which is, again, in this case, getting to recommend an idea for a show. And we said, that sounds awesome. So if you're interested in supporting the network, please go to our Patreon, which is patreon.com/FWpodcast, and consider supporting the network. Paul, I gotta say, I'm excited. I had never read these before.
Same.
Well, I was wondering about that. Part of the reason I volunteered is I had all the issues, and I haven't read them since they came out 35 years ago, and so I was excited to reread them.
I want to give a shout out to Darren and Ruth Sutherland, because they love mysteries. As you guys know, over at the Rad Adventure Network, they've got mystery shows and things like that, and they actually recommended this to me a long time ago, and as I usually do with Darren and Ruth, I just kind of nodded my head and smiled and went, okay, sure, and moved on, and just try to forget everything they ever told me, because they are the most dangerous people in podcasting. But then when Michael suggested this, it was like, okay, sure. All right. That's the second endorsement. All right. And it's been an absolute blast reading them.
Well, we've organized the podcast as follows. First, we're going to talk in general for a brief time about the mystery genre. We're going to then run through a publication history of Maze Agency and a couple brief bios of Mike W. Barr and Adam Hughes. Adam Hughes illustrated about 8 issues of the series. We're going to do a medium dive on the first 5 that he did and commentary on the rest of the series. And then we'll wrap up with some general comments and whether we'd like to see more Maze Agency, either in comics or some other medium. So first off, mystery genre. You guys fans? Do you watch any TV shows, movies, role-playing games?
Yeah, well, who doesn't in some way watch mysteries, whether it's cop shows or even spy stuff? There's a lot of mystery going on. A lot of TV shows, even superhero TV shows, etc., are built around probably some sort of conspiracy that is like a continuing subplot or whatever. So everybody watches mystery. Do they like it? And are there different versions of mysteries? So I like it, but I think I prefer the psychological stories, the psychological aspects of mysteries. Father Brown rather than Sherlock Holmes. Mm. I'm very bad at guessing, at guessing the solutions. So Sherlock Holmes, it's like, well, I can't guess that because I don't know every kind of mud in London, that kind of thing. But Father Brown, for example, or mysteries like that, because there's a psychological element, you're thinking, well, maybe I didn't guess it, but I can relate. The motives make sense, and divine the motives, to me, that makes more sense than the science stuff, the CSI stuff that I don't really have in my life or anything. Like I said, I rarely get the solution because my brain doesn't work that way. I don't normally work to predict a story when I'm enjoying it. Some people are going to see the movies. It doesn't need to be a mystery. And it sort of spoils their enjoyment because they kind of know, they can see the strings dangling and they kind of know what's going to happen. It's, oh, well, I guessed it. But I never try to guess it. My brain doesn't do that necessarily. And so, therefore, I gravitate to things where we already know the killer. Columbo, for example, which is a backwards mystery because we saw it happen, but how is the detective going to figure it out? Is the actual mystery in a way, or where you can't trust the suspects or even the detective because they're not showing you everything and then you keep flashbacking and you learn more information. I recently fell into a vat of Spanish films. There's this director, Oriol Paulo, I guess, hasn't done a lot of movies yet. He's still pretty new. And there is a miniseries as well. It's on Netflix. But all his movies are, it's like, you can't trust anything. He keeps throwing twists at you, even in the last shot, where you learn more about what's going on. But they're very intricate mysteries. And I do love that. But I think I love it because I'm almost guessing it, but I'm always wrong. And, you know, and revising my thoughts. So I think that when the audience member becomes the detective, oh, you did something right.
That's awesome. Siskoid, like you, I enjoy a mystery in a genre that I'm already enjoying or whatever. Whereas you said you kind of go along for the ride. My brain's constantly going, I want to solve it. I want to solve it. And I am exceptionally good at being wrong, as we will find out as we go through the Maze Agency. While I enjoy it, I'm awful at it. Sort of like Siskoid, I Googled defining mysteries. I was like, you know, it's really broad. Because when you think mysteries, you think Sherlock Holmes, right? But then you start looking, give me a list of mystery TV shows. Okay, here are some ones that I love that are no-brainers. Psych, Moonlighting, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, Remington Steele, Rockford Files, Scooby-Doo. You know, those are all obvious mysteries. And then you get to broaden the scope of it. There's other shows that I wouldn't even think of as being a mystery, but they absolutely are because there's a puzzle box in there, like Flash Forward, which is a great mystery show.
Oh, I love that show. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. X-Files, Prison Break, House, Expanse, all these are technically mysteries. It's interesting they fall in that genre. And I was going to say this for later, but yes, Siskoid, you described a genre, and I didn't know how to name, but you mentioned Columbo. Both Columbo and Poker Face fall into the genre of not whodunit, but it's called How Ketchum.
How Ketchum, yeah.
Yeah.
Because there's why done it and how done it. And that one's what you said.
Yeah, How Ketchum. It's hard to say. It's easier when I can see it in writing. What about you, Paul?
You know, I like it. For example, enjoyed the recent Poirot movies and the Knives Out and Glass Onion Netflix
sure,
movies.
Yes. Oh, like yeah.
You know, I enjoyed all those movies, but the biggest source of it for me is probably through my wife, who's a huge Masterpiece on PBS fan. We were watching Endeavor. You mentioned Father Brown. She loves Father Brown. I haven't really watched that one, Siskoid, but she loves that one. All those up in the Cotswolds in England, they have a lot of murders up in that
island. Yeah, it's a little murder she wrote up there. I've never watched that show, though, but I have read the short stories by Chesterton. And there is a movie, an old movie with Alec Guinness in the role that is quite fun. I think it's the first Father Brown ever put to film. And so got some love for that as well.
Over the summer, we watched Magpie Murders, which was a book and then a 6-part story. And I loved that. And then I read the book and then I read the sequel, which they're making the second season out of. I read a lot, not just comic books, but this is an interesting area for me. From a comics perspective, last year, I went back and read Ms. Tree. I don't know if either of you guys read that.
Not familiar with it.
Yeah, that's different than Maze Agency. That's more the hard-boiled Mickey Splaine. She's rubbing people out, kind of rough justice.
Mm-hmm.
They're written by Max Allen Collins, who wrote the infamous Jason Todd stealing the wheels off the Batmobile. And then, of course, there's various, read a lot of Batman stories over the years, and some are more detective oriented than others.
It's interesting that you mention, Mike Barr actually mentions Miss Tree in the back matter, the first issue of Maze Agency, mm-hmm. as something like the opposite of Maze Agency. That's good, and you know, you should read it, but it's the opposite because Miss Tree, or I think this also covers Batman, the focus is on the detective rather than the mystery. There's action, and you're not supposed to solve, as a reader, you're not supposed to solve or be able to solve the mystery because you're discovering the clues as you go, and the detective is smarter than you are and maybe not letting you in on it. Whereas what we're going to talk about today, yes, you are supposed to be able to, right?
He calls it, in theory, the, quote, fair play detective story.
The fair play.
Yeah, I don't know how fair it really is. Like you guys, I can't solve them either. I can spot a number of clues. I say, oh, that's significant, but I'm usually totally wrong as to what the significance of that clue was.
Well, so let's talk about that. So again, this fair play whodunits. So do you have a history with fair play whodunits?
To me, they're all just, I mean, a whodunit is a whodunit. I read some Agatha Christie when I was a kid. So I don't remember necessarily the details. One of my girls in the hot squad is an expert in Agatha Christie, so she talks about it a lot. And she assures me that they are fair play.
Mm-hmm.
There's enough information there that you could figure it out. Or if you can't figure it out, because we're all dumb, I guess. If you can't figure it out, then when you go back and say, oh, yes, the clues were there. It does make sense. I just didn't pick up on that clue because I'm not Miss Marple. I think Maze Agency is supposed to be like that.
Yeah.
Plus you get the art, which you can have clues in the art alone, which is going to be an interesting part of this. One of my questions I have about comics as mysteries is because comics are so short, usually you don't have the time to think about it too much. Can you really start to suspect someone and then see if your suspicions are realized or not? Because novels and movies are much longer and have an advantage in that sense. TV shows, not always. I feel sometimes you watch a cop show and once you're done with all the soap opera stuff, the continuing things and the, you know, the comedy bits or whatever it is, there's not enough suspects. You're going to go, well, it's obviously this guy. Obviously the biggest guest star, you know? So they're easy to guess sometimes, but they often turn into how done it's and why done it's and how will the detective prosecute the perpetrator, because there's no real mystery in who it is because they have small casts. But movies like, talked about Knives Out, huge cast. We played a pool. We had a pool going before we went to the movie. We didn't know anything. Who suspects this actor or this actor or this actor? And we don't know anything. So somebody picked the guy that died, or, you know, we don't know. Or the detective, like that first time, which I think we knew who the detective was because of the trailers. And then we see who wins. And it, I mean, it's a guess. And it's a guess in the dark, right? It's not the same thing.
What you ought to do is stop it halfway. Sometimes I'll pause it three quarters of the way through. I was like, all right, who do you think did it? We'll talk about it.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Well, yeah.
In those cases, it was kind of hard. I mean, I don't think the theater would have.
They actually do that in the comic where a couple times.
Yeah,
they'll turn to the reader and go, okay, we're ready to say it. Do you know who it is?
Yeah, exactly. That's fun.
It's fun. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess Glass Onion went direct to streaming, so maybe that could have been done there. But they have a large cast, and comics, you have to keep it pretty small. You don't have a budget, so you can put as many people as you want, but you don't have a lot of space to present them. I think Maze Agency is an example of it working, but generally, do you think comics are well adapted to this sort of story, or do we need to be like the recent Human Target comic where there can be a large cast and you don't know who did it, and but it's 12 issues.
Right. Well, that's what I was going to say, is one of the things he did here is every one of the issues of Maze Agencies was a done in one, and that includes the two miniseries that were published later, which is a rarity in and of itself today, right? Mm-hmm. And so you could see an original graphic novel or a miniseries or what have you, and then you have that time to think about it. The problem with the periodical publication, of course, then you forget what's going on. You forget what I did yesterday. So it's hard to remember from one month to the next the different characters.
Well, nowadays, everything's written for the trade. So you could do that. But I think it's hard to answer the questions. It's going to, other than saying, well, they made it work here. So I'd say it can be done in comics. As far as my history with whodunits, thanks for asking. Specifically, I only have limited exposure to Sherlock Holmes, the various incarnations. I've seen some of the bigger name stuff. Sure. I'm glad you mentioned Knives Out and Glass Onion. I completely forgot about that one. That's absolutely a great example of a fair play whodunit. All the clues are there.
And Death on the Nile.
Orient Express. And there's a third one coming out.
I haven't seen those. And there's other stuff too. You guys are going to roll your eyes. But I went through a period of time where I was binging CSI Miami like a fiend. I couldn't get enough of David Caruso taking his glasses off and be like, well, wow, you know, the opening scream and all that. And those are whodunits. I mean, you can pretty much figure it out as you go along. I don't know if it's fair play necessarily, but it's pretty much whodunits. And then there's another one I'm actually a big fan of right now, Only Murders in the Building.
I forgot about that one.
Love that show. I haven't started the new season yet, but I'm so excited. Now, specifically to Agatha Christie, Siskoid, this year, actually, I decided to read an Agatha Christie book. I read the first Poirot mystery, and it is very much a fair play. All the clues are there. It's just a matter of how you interpret them. I didn't miss clues. They're pretty obvious, at least in that one. It's very like, okay, that's a clue. But it's how you interpret what it means, which, of course, I got it wrong because I'm an idiot. Yeah. But
you need Poirot to interpret it for you.
But by the end, I was able to go, okay, yeah, that makes sense. I totally see why that person did it, but I didn't get there on my own. What about you, Paul? Whodunits?
Same kind of thing. I'm not very good at guessing, but like you, I've been able to spot them, but I don't usually interpret them correctly. Other whodunits, when I was a kid, I read some Agatha Christie. It's been many years. I enjoy those types of movies. And this Magpie Murders was really interesting. It was a modern story intertwined with a fictional detective. The TV show went back and forth. The way the books work is you get half of the modern day story, then you get a whole 1950s story in the middle, and then you get the back half of the modern day story. The author of this series of books starring the fictional detective was the one who was murdered in the present day. And so that was really very, very clever. And so I highly recommend that. Alrighty, let's move on. Let's talk about the publication history of the Maze Agency. So as we mentioned, Maze Agency's Fair Play Whodunit, they were all written and created by Mike W. Barr. The lead characters are Jennifer Maze, who is an intelligent and gorgeous owner of the PI and security firm, the Maze Agency. Gabriel Webb is the other lead. He's a crime fiction novelist. He's a bit of a slob, but he's also a great detective. And what's great about it is there's a lot of interplay between the two, and we get to see their relationship develop over the course of the series. Just so you know, back issue number 2, I know we cite back issue, the Tomorrow's publication, a lot in podcasts here on the network, but back issue number 2, the very second issue from 2004, is a main source of a lot of stuff that we're going to talk about from a history perspective. It sports a great Adam Hughes cover of Jennifer Mays cosplaying as Justice Girl, which was taken from the cover of issue number 13. And why is that? Well, Michael Urey, who created and is the editor of Back Issue, was the editor of the Mays Agency, thus the connection helping him launch his magazine. It's long sold out of print copies, but I'll post a link for the digital copy in the show notes. So Mike W. Barr in the mid-80s came up with this. He said, I wanted to do a creator-owned detective series with actual mysteries, actual whodunits, which would be solvable by the reader based on my love of classic detective stories of Ellery Queen, who shows up in issue 9, of course. None of us mentioned Ellery Queen because none of us probably watched it when we were kids.
Not a clue. First time I've ever heard the name.
He said that he did some mystery type stories when he wrote Batman, but of course, with Batman, you have to have a degree of physical action, so not the same. So Barr went to, quote, the best artist he had worked with, which is Alan Davis, and Alan Davis designed the characters in the Mays Agency, and he drew a spec story to sell the series. That spec story later appeared in the Mays Agency special and is reproduced in its entirety in this issue of Back Issue. Originally, they thought it was going to be sold to Archie Goodwin and Epic Comics, who was excited about it, but when he saw it, he immediately passed, which Mike wasn't too thrilled about. And when Epic passed on it, so did Alan. So he went to Kimiko, who was more interested in real world stuff. And then he found Adam Hughes at a convention in Philadelphia. Shag will talk a little bit more about Adam in a few minutes. There's a great narrative in the article from Adam about how much he learned from doing Maze and from Mike, which is real nice. And there's sample pages in the article here that you can look up. It's really neat. And there's an interesting story about how he learned to do his own inking by practicing on the back covers for the next issue. So you'll notice on a lot of these comics, the back cover is a preview of what's coming in the next issue. It's not the actual cover of the next issue. It's just an illustration that Adam did, and he practiced inking. So the Ashcan of five-page story was handed out at the 1988 San Diego Comic-Con. The series went 7 issues at Kimiko, went on hiatus when Kimiko was having financial troubles, and that's when Adam got the call to do Justice League International from DC. Kimiko had a distribution deal with DC, and they heard, even though it wasn't publicly announced yet, through the grapevine that it was going to be canceled. And the same day that Adam got the news that the Mays Agency was canceled, DC called him and said, you want to do Justice League. Mm. Mike W. Barr offered the Mays Agency to DC, who said, quote, we got the artist. We don't need the book.
Oh, no.
And after a couple of months, though, Innovation picked it up, and it went from issues 8 to 23 with some great guest cover artists. Alan Davis did do one on a Christmas cover, but there was also Mike Plug, Russ Heath, Norm freaking Breyfogle did a cover, Brian Bolin, Tom Mandrake, Brian Stelfreeze, and others. There was an editorial from Mike W. Barr in issue 22 saying the sales are tough, and Mays Agency was staying afloat mainly due to European sales, which I found fascinating. It was selling better in Denmark than the US. So then they thought about shifting to black and white, but of course it was canceled with the following issue. In 1998, Caliber published a 3-issue miniseries. I didn't find that one very good. And IDW did 3 issues in 2004 to 2005, which was a little better, but that's it. And in an interview, Barr was asked, would there ever be more Mays Agency? And he said he'd love to do a prose novel, which I think would be fascinating. We talk about that more at the end, or more comics. But he said, quote, I don't know if I'll ever have a chance to revive it, but it's kind of nice to think that they're out there somewhere still solving the crimes and making the romance.
That's awesome.
Siskoy, do you want to tell listeners a little bit about Mike W. Barr?
Sure. So Mike W. Barr his first success was Being Born in 1952, and followed by his first published story, Elongated Man, Backup in Detective 444. So already he's into detective fiction, right? He's editor at DC from 81 to 87. Some of the highlights, Camelot 3000 with Brian Bolland in 82 to 84, by the time that wrapped. The first Green Arrow limited series with Trevor Von Eden, that's in 1983. There's a great article about the series in Back Issue number 137. So let's plug Back Issue once again. Brave and the Bold, of course, several issues, including 200, because that's where we get the switch over, basically, to Batman and the Outsiders with Jim Aparo. So there's several Outsider series that he wrote and created: Katana, Halo, Geo-Force, and later Looker. I'm not saying these are all good. and a lot of villains like Force of July, the Nuclear Family. Again, this is not my rubber stamp on anything Outsiders related.
I love that you got stuck talking about the Outsiders. I love it. Specifically you.
Yeah. 1987 is a big year for Mike Barr. Batman Year 2 comes out. He's got Todd McFarlane. He's got Alan Davis on it in Detective Comics. The Reaper returns in the graphic novel Batman Full Circle. And of course, this is a plot that inspired Batman Mask of the Phantasm, which many considered the best Batman feature film. And also that year, Batman Son of the Demon with Jerry Bingham. So we have him and later Grant Morrison to thank for Damien. That's where stuff happens with Talia. Okay. Then Maze Agency is launched, right? This is like 1988 at Comico or Comico as...
I already said it. Comico. Do you say Comico?
I say Comico because it's comic and I don't judge your pronunciation as if it were your Japanese girlfriend. It's fine. So... In 1989 and 90, he's writing DC's version of Doc Savage, including the first ever team up with The Shadow. Then Mantra for Malibu Comics. That was a weird one. He's written for animation with episodes of Young Justice, of Beware the Batman, of the Lego DC Superhero Girl, Supervillain High. He's done a lot of stuff like that. And apparently, according to the Simon & Schuster website, probably the first person to write for all four pre-Enterprise incarnations of Star Trek in one form or another, essentially either in novels or comic books. And many other credits. I think Paul will leave a link in the show notes for people who are interested to find out more of his work.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And Chad, you're up for Adam Hughes.
Sure. So Adam Hughes, he comes on with no formal comic training. This guy didn't go to art school, none of that stuff. And he goes to conventions and gets picked up. He ends up doing some pinups in this comic called Eagle. He does it number 6. He pencils 2 short stories in the first issue of Deathhawk. And then he gets this gig for Maze Agency, as you talked about. They picked him up from a convention. And it's interesting. I hope I'm remembering the back issue article I read correctly. But if I remember right, Michael Urie wanted to woo Adam Hughes over to do this, so he took him to Burger King, if I remember right. That was his effort to woo Adam Hughes.
That's the budget that they had.
Right, exactly, at Comico Comico. Anyway, they woo him, and they get him on board, and it's his first ongoing series. Not that you could tell by looking at it. We'll talk more about that in a bit, but there's just no way you could think this guy is his first work. You already mentioned it, Paul. He credits Mike W. Barr and Maze Agency for really helping him grow as an artist, really where a lot of that came in. Then 1989, you guys mentioned it, he gets picked up for Justice League America, right? Which is the Keith Giffen, J.M. DeMatteis era. He's taking over for, oh, wow, I'm blanking.
Ty Templeton, right? By that
time. Yeah, thank you. Wow. It's almost like I do a show about the book every month.
I screwed up Richard Brier's name earlier, so.
I'm really excited about the next thing. That's where I got distracted. So he starts with issue 31, and he only does about 12 issues, which blows my mind, because it feels like he was on the book forever, but he only does about 12 issues. And the cool thing is, in Justice League America number 34, which is the issue where they're on Kahui, Kahui, Kahui. It's the one where Beetle and Booster put together a casino. Everyone loves this issue. So Adam Hughes draws it, draws the hell out of it. And in one of the panels, he puts a cameo where you see Jennifer Maze, you see Gabriel Webb, you see Lieutenant Bliss. They're all there on the island at the resort, which is absolutely hilarious if you know what you're looking for, which is great. Now, at the same time that he's doing this, working this gig for Justice League America, he's still working in a comic shop 2 days a week because he's got to pay the bills, which is kind of funny. Then he breaks out. He's super famous now. He explodes. In 1992, he does a graphic novel, Star Trek Debt of Honor, which he does with Chris Claremont. So if you're a Star Trek fan and you've never read it, come on, Chris Claremont, Adam Hughes, what a pedigree. Check that out.
It's a big one, yeah.
Then he starts to do less and less interior work because let's face it, he's Adam Hughes. He doesn't need to. So he's doing covers. So he's doing covers for Wonder Woman. He does that for 4 years. Then he does 4 years on Catwoman. He does some amazing posters for DC, like the Real Power of the DC Universe, the one with all the women. The guy is just a breakout artist everywhere. He did Batgirl covers during the New 52. He did a bunch of those. He has the opportunity to do whatever he wants because he is a legendary name in the industry at this point. Everyone recognizes his art, whether it's amazing art or gorgeous women, whatever. You recognize the AH every time you see it with the exclamation point. Then, and this is interesting because there's not a lot of information on this, but in May 2022, Adam Hughes said he was no longer producing comics full-time anymore, and he was doing character designs and concept art for Marvel Studios Animation. Now, because of the way his contracts works and all that, it's not out there for us to see, but I would kill to see the designs of what he's doing for Marvel. That would be amazing.
That'll be neat when that finally comes out.
Yeah.
And that's a clue that Shag is the murderer.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. Let's dive in. What we're going to do, listeners, is I'm going to read a very short synopsis of the situation, I guess I should say. It's not the whole plot, of the situation that our heroes find themselves in each of these first 5 issues. And then we'll just kind of go around the horn and talk about art, the mystery, was it fair, to the best of our abilities, without getting any spoilers away. So the first one, the issue number 1, is called The Adventure of the Rogues Gallery. An art auction is threatened by an infamous art thief named The Rogue, and Jennifer and Gabe are on the case. The robber strikes, shooting the night watchman, but he leaves behind the paintings. Instead, they stole the frames. Who done it and why? So what do you guys think of this one? Let's start with you, Siskoid. Let's talk about the cover and then we'll get into the story.
I like the cover. You get your two principals and they're in fun poses. They're kind of looking towards us because this is a comic that engages the reader in the mystery solving. And then Webb is holding he's just like spinning a magnifying glass on his finger and she's got the gun, which sort of points to, I mean, there are secrets about her that we find out later. You know, there is a continuing plot in here somewhere just as a character discovery. And in the background, very dark, you've got people trapped in a maze. So that fits the very cool logo, I must say. That's a very cool logo for the maze.
Yeah, the logo's great. I love that logo.
So to describe it for you folks at home, the logo is literally like a maze.
Like a maze.
Yeah, like where you sit there and draw and try and figure it out. Did anyone try and draw the path?
Not tried to do that. I bet it works.
I've done it with my finger like in the air, right? I'm not drawing on my book. But like, I've done it. It seems to be real, as near as I could tell. Yeah, you could like legitimately solve the maze.
Yeah, I think it works.
Which would make sense for this book.
And then you got a banner at the bottom, which is like murder weapons. Very graphic. So there's a lot of elements, but somehow it works. And I think it shows that this is going to be a mystery series, of course, but also have a sense of fun. And I think that's realized in the interior.
Well, I'm in a little bit of a different situation because I bought the Innovation trade paperback off eBay, which collects the first four issues upon the recommendation of Michael Crouch, our patron here. And so, first of all, mine's in black and white. So I don't even have color. I'll be honest, I didn't know until I got to issue 5 that this series was even in color. I thought the series was in black and white. I'm like, well, it's an independent in the 80s. Of course it's in black and white. So once I get to issue 5 and I read one in color, I go back and I found out all the stuff's in color and I missed it. Now, you know, the nice thing is I got a chance to see Adam Hughes' artwork sort of in a more raw form without the color distracting it. So I got a really chance to study it. But either way, love the cover. I've got it without all the trade dress. I've got just the artwork. So I didn't get to see all that other stuff. Let's just put it out there because it's going to come up, guys. You're all waiting for me to say it. Yes, Jennifer Mace is smoking hot. Period. End of story. We don't have to harp on it. We're going to, though.
He's not the only one in this book. You've got Lieutenant Bliss. Right. You've got Ashley, her rival.
Pretty much every woman's gorgeous in this book because it's Adam Hughes. By the way, one of the things I want to mention, too, that you didn't mention is her name is Jennifer Mays, M-A-Y-S, where it's Mays Agency, M-A-Z-E. That is brilliant naming. I think that's just super clever. Either way, great cover. You guys already said everything that needs to be said.
The only thing I'll add is one of the things we're introduced to on the cover, you got Jennifer, who's, as you said, a gorgeous blonde. She's got this big forelock curl that's very distinctive. It's easy for us to tell who, you know, among all the other gorgeous women in the story, who she is. Alan Davis designed that.
Yes.
So how about the story? Did you guys figure out any of the aspects of it? Like, why was it just the frames or who was the rogue or who stole the frames? Anything?
No.
Good Lord, no. I sure tried, but I failed.
I like that Mike Barr is, in each of these stories, or almost all of the stories, it's like he's finding an angle. It's very tough to write a mystery story that we haven't seen before, or that doesn't feel familiar. So comics tends to be more genre. Let's get some genre elements in here that you might not see in your traditional cop show or in your drawing room mystery from Agatha Christie or whatever. So the idea that there's a sort of mystery thief, gentleman thief of some kind called the Rogue, who does this strange crime. Already, I feel this is a little more comic booky than your typical television mystery plot. So I really enjoy that. And in terms of art, it's kind of unbelievable that Adam Hughes is so green in this because I think it's already all there, you know, like the expression's all there. The sexiness is all there. He has some interesting layouts. He has a nice control of things in shadow, hiding things. He does a good cap. Very tough doing a good cap, I've always found, whether it's Mike Barr's decision or whatever, but there's no qualm in doing almost silent pages that just let the art speak. You don't get thought bubbles in a Maze Agency story. A lot of people talk. There's a lot of talking. But when it's a silent scene, it goes by without captions. You need to have a lot of confidence in your artist to let that play out that way. So I feel it's kind of a shame what you were saying earlier, Shag, that eventually he turned to doing mostly covers because his storytelling style is so fun, so expressive, that it's a shame that we don't have more interior stories with him on art.
All right. I couldn't agree more because he learned a lot here, but then he goes on and gets Keith Giffen because Keith Giffen does the breakdowns on JLA, right? So goodness gracious, what an amazing set of teachers for him. And so the panel design, I haven't read Silk Spectre series he did, but he did the interiors on that. And it almost makes me want to read it. Well, obviously, okay, beautiful woman, he's drawing her, but the panel design would probably be great. That's one of my notes as well, is that you see here the layouts, the storytelling, the panel design, those are amazing for issue number one. And those are down to him. Part of this magic is Rick Magyar's inking. Okay. So yes, Rick Magyar is a great inker. And in fact, as you read along later, Rob Phipps takes over the book for a while and Rick Magyar inks him as well. And there is a very similar polished look to the characters. Jennifer still looks the same. Gabe looks the same. There's still a sexiness, a very good shine to them. But the layouts, the storytelling, the panel design, that you're seeing here is Adam. Rick certainly inked it, but Adam had to be the one to do that. And it's great. There's no confusion. I mean, a mystery story is damn hard to tell for starters, but for someone who has very little experience drawing, to be able to pull it off with no flaw, there's no point where I don't know what's going on. And so that is really, really amazing. And I want to touch on the plot idea real quick. I love the whole idea of stealing the frames and not the paintings as your first issue. Because like you said, Siskoid, Agatha Christie stories, okay, who's the killer? Well, this is something different. It makes it a great launching point that gets your attention and you say, okay, not only is it a comic whodunit, this is an interesting story. This is telling me something different. And I think that's part of what gets the attention.
I agree 100%. I mentioned before I had been 30 years since I read these. I didn't remember the details of the whodunit, but I remembered the why they stole the frames instead of the paintings because it was just so memorable. I love also that Gabe and Jennifer are a real team. At the end, they each solve a piece of the mystery, which I think was terrific and an excellent touch. And we see that many times throughout the series. I just think that the way that their teamwork develops, both as professional teamwork as well as the personal relationship, really outstanding. And just what you talked earlier about, it's great to have these fun plots and how these things are done and who did it. But to see the development over time of the relationships is really terrific.
Yeah. At the same time, this is the first issue and already these characters know each other.
Yep.
They're at the start of a relationship. They're not necessarily monogamous. It's not a will they, won't they. It's a will they. So they play this relationship, which I think they're more into lust with one another than love at the beginning, but it's kind of a real relationship. People who enjoy each other, dating, etc., but it's not necessarily love yet, but there's a fun partnership and chemistry between them. And they kind of play it for humor very often. But again, I mean, this series will have silent pages of just them kissing in the corner or something, you know? It feels very romantic, even though that's not necessarily the focus. So I enjoy that as well. It's like we're thrown into a situation. There's no pilot. This is it. These are the characters. We're already there. They're already having a dynamic and we get to the mystery because that's what we're here for.
You make a good point about that, which is one of the things I want to bring up is being thrown right into it with no pilot. I like that phrasing because there's some seeds here that I didn't pick up on the first time I read these that I did the second time. We are very much thrown into their lives and we're not told everything.
No.
For example, there's a discussion in here about Jennifer. Her heart still hurts because of her previous relationship with a guy named Arthur, who they never tell us the details.
We never find out.
All we can sort of piece together is that Arthur was a cop and he died, but also, and this is sort of telling that they don't really dwell on it, Arthur was married and his wife blames Jennifer for his death. It's like one mention in one word balloon in one issue. It's like they just throw it out there and it's gone and move on. So Jennifer was essentially, I don't know whether she was having an affair with this guy or whether maybe him and his wife were separated. I don't know. And we're never going to find out. And that's okay. At least not in the first 12 issues. Maybe you do later. I don't know.
We don't. We never find out.
Okay. So it's sort of interesting. Like you said, we're thrown in the middle and we're just going. Folks, another thing too that is appealing about this series is, all right, look, who reads comic books, especially in 1989? Guys, all right, for the most part. And so what you end up here is this schleppy guy who's got glasses and he's barely making the rent is making out with a woman who is so achingly sexually attractive. That is just like every fanboy's dream. Because I mean, you read these pages and it makes you yearn because Adam Hughes has drawn the most beautiful woman ever, and she just gets more beautiful issue by issue.
He doesn't have the fullest hairline.
Yeah, he's not buff like Superman. Or
no,
he's kind of a Clark Kent type, but then a little goofy, a little schlubby, a little...
He's the reader at home. I mean, that's the whole point of it, and that's part of the magic.
Before we leave this issue, any particular page or panels or anything that you really like that you want to point out? I have one or two that I'll start with. On page 7, one of the things that Adam Hughes is really good at is the fashion. Jennifer wears a lot of high fashion, different types of outfits. She's in a pantsuit with a hat at the top of the page, and then she's in her evening attire, and Gabe's in his tux. I love the panels at the bottom. They're walking into the exhibit arm in arm, and she stops and smiles at him and straightens his tie. So that's very playful.
Before you leave, just look at his body language. On the second to the last panel, the tie is uncomfortable. He's pulling at it. He's got like a face like, argh. That's amazing art. It's amazing work to give that sort of body language.
Incredible. But then there are arguing couple about the paintings at the exhibit. And then we get a foreshadowing of some issues in the future. And Gabe says, sad, two people used to love each other. Now they're fighting like worst enemies. And she says, I know. It reminds me of my parents. And and there's this really far away look in her eyes and shadowed off to the, what do you call that, side lit, I guess. Mm-hmm. I was really impressed with that sequence of pages.
For me, pages 10, 11, and 12, honestly, I could pick any page. They're all amazing. And I do like how a lot of times too, I should mention, he'll do the first page as a title page. It's not every issue. And I'm trying to see if this issue's got one. Yeah, the first page is almost a splash page, teaser, title page. But either way, pages 10, 11, and 12, they're dancing. Again, you can see the fashion that she's wearing. He's got music notes in the background behind them. I mean, which is incredibly clever to do as an artist. The zip-a-tone on the face of Gabe at the top of that page. And then later on, what you talked about, Cisco, the silent panels on page 11, where they're making out. And then you just see the frames and you see the museum and you see the guard who's tired and he's pouring coffee. And then later on, 12, all the black borders where the guard is shot. That's so damn good.
I'll go and add 13 to that, because look at that moment where she gets a call. Because there's been a murder. Well, not a murder. He's, I guess, at the hospital. What hospital? I'll be right there. And then the next panel, she's just looking at her phone. And then she calls Gabe. So there's a moment of, okay, yes, I'm going to call this guy. Like, at this point, he's only helping out on mysteries and sort of, he's not yet associated with the agency, really. So she decides, yeah, I'm going to wake him up. Yeah, I'm going to need him for this. A very good character moment and great expression.
Clearly, she's been asleep. Her hair is a little messed up, tousled a little bit. I agree with you. And another foreshadowing, Gabe says, listen, if this is the lady downstairs,
yes!
I mean, Mike W. Oh, Moore has this worked out.
Yeah. Where's the beef lady?
Right.
Is downstairs banging. And later, well, later she gets murdered.
Yeah, all the way to issue 8. Right. Yeah. So he's laying the seeds here. It's awesome.
Okay. We said we would do real quick. That was issue 1.
All right. Well, you know, that was the first one. We'll pick up the pace.
We set the table.
Yeah. Because if we sit here and pick apart the art, I mean, we will be here all night because every page is worth celebrating.
Issue number 2 is called Murder the Lost Episodes. The son of a popular 1950s sitcom discovers 9 lost episodes and promptly is murdered. Unfortunately, Gabe's friend Lewis is accused of the crime, so Jennifer and Gabe set out to clear his name and find the real killer.
Talk about the cover on this. We've got the mysterious killer shooting a mysterious victim in the foreground, and our stars are actually in the background on a television screen as if they were black and white and shocked at the action that is happening in real life. So it's a clever reversal of what is actually sort of happening, although of course they don't witness the murder or anything.
And that's the word I have written down, is clever. It's the inverse of the story where the TV personality is the one that gets murdered. I actually remembered one or two of the clues on this one too. I think it's very clever mystery. I enjoyed this story even better than the first one. Talk about the interior art. Any comments or sections you want to call out? Shaq?
If I start going down this path, I'm just going to mention every page. That's my problem, is I don't want to get too hung up on saying this page, this page, this page. I will defer to the senator from New Brunswick, please.
Yeah, this one's more of a, I don't know, this one's more of a classic kind of mystery where you might see that on a television show because it deals with television. There's something about the first one where it's the art world and there's a visual art element to comics, and they were stealing frames, and comics are frames around panels. In this case, it is a television plot. It very much is a television plot, but it still works, and it's got an interesting, well, I don't want to say the, obviously I don't want
to
say.
Right. It's really hard to talk about this one without talking about this one.
Yeah. I feel like this one, more than any of the others, discussing it too much will reveal the solution. But
so let's talk about your favorite relationship parts then. For example, page 8, I love how Gabe just interrupts Jen's date with another man without even realizing. And then in the cab later, she says, Gabriel Webb, you're jealous. And he said, jealous me? I just love that page. I just think that's hysterical.
I agree. And then there's going to be a reversal later. More
yes.
Or less,
oh, yes, there is.
Which is pretty funny as well. If we're looking at art that's well structured, interesting perspectives, I'll mention page 11, where the camera is in the closet as they are in different closets, I think, as they are rummaging through a person's apartment.
Yeah, that's very cool.
It's very cool. And like, they're in darkness because there's no light coming out of that closet, and the other character is in the background. So, and it flips back and forth. This is the kind of pretty creative layouts, or it's more than layouts, because it's just how you motivate your angles. And I think there's a lot of that. It has to be, because these are comics where people are talking a lot, because they are theorizing, they are interviewing people, they are explaining, like there's exposition to explain the solutions. And because of that, it could be very static. It could be very boring, just like talking heads. So keeping the camera mobile, I call it a camera, and, you know, zooming in, zooming out, looking at these little details, having the characters in the corner, switching things around, I think is key to making this an interesting series.
I deferred on the art, but I will say, as far as the story goes, I love this plot. And I love the twists and turns. I think if I had to say which is my favorites, I think the first two issues from a story crime perspective, I think they're my favorites.
Oh, yeah.
I really, really love the way this story rolls out. And then the aha moment when you're like, why is, oh, that's why, you know, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Really, really enjoy these two.
Page 13, I think it's very funny where Jen is propositioned by the owner of the porno video company.
Right.
And she's like, goodbye, Mr. York, with the icicles dripping from the word balloon, and just love it. The facial expressions and the body language are just terrific. Yeah, you're right. It's hard to discuss much more about this one without really giving away too much of the plot.
Well, we got a lot more issues to go.
Yeah, let's move on. Number three is called The Case of the Vanishing Vehicle. Jennifer and Gabe investigate the disappearance of an experimental test auto right during a blackout in a sealed room. Along the way, we meet Jennifer's former employer, Ashley Swift. Sparks fly, but where Gabe and Jennifer find the car before Ashley does. So, cover, not my favorite. I get what they were going for. The cover is a steering wheel with three different images, Gabe and Jen in one, a car blowing up in another, and a car turning up in the third. But it's not my favorite. I don't think it really highlights the characters that well, but maybe you guys disagree.
I think it's clever because you get the three sections of the steering wheel and you get to see a lot of different action going on. I mean, it's two of them are kind of explosion related, so maybe they could have picked something different, but I think it's perfectly fine. I think it tells you it's a car mystery.
Yeah,
I agree. And I think for such a new artist to already be doing Maverick stuff like this, I don't know what the inspiration is from his point of view, but he's not doing the ordinary thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I enjoy that.
And how'd he get away with putting Chevrolet on the cover?
Yeah. I don't know. It was a different time.
Right.
I'll say this. I did notice one clue on page 21, bottom left. I'm not going to say what it was, but I did not interpret it right.
Okay, so I've been waiting for this one to talk about something. Oh, I see the clue you're talking about. Yeah. First off, I do have some favorite art pages, but when you're ready, I actually have ones for that. But I think this is the first one, and one of the few ones, where I don't feel the, without spoiling anything, the mystery plays fair. I feel like it's the mystery of the disappearing car, without saying any more there. I don't feel like it plays fair because I feel like there's not enough clues to solve it, because in the solution, there is a wild leap of speculation.
I think it's more speculative is what you're saying.
Yeah. I think you're asking more of the reader in that case to make that jump. Again, we can't talk about the details, but does anyone else feel that this one doesn't play fair?
I think it's harder when you go back and say, yeah, okay, as opposed to, oh. So I agree with you to some degree there.
Yeah, maybe. Like I said, I'm so bad at guessing these things. Whether they're fair or not is not always clear to me. I do enjoy that they get to do something a little different in terms of the action, because you got some car action in there. And he doesn't do a splash page in this one, but it still works as a sort of introduction to the issue, because
right,
it's a commercial that they shot for the Maze Agency, and Jennifer doesn't think it's very good. but it's introducing the series and then the way that it might introduce the agency within the world.
Because maybe people didn't pick up issues one and two, so you might as well give them an introduction.
As always, it's all the stuff that is just personal to them. And I like how later mysteries, like later in the series, start to get more personal. Yeah, people in their lives, you know, they go Murder, She Wrote, but not so much that it doesn't make any sense anymore. But the personal stuff in here, like Gabe's editor, he's writing up these mysteries afterwards for a magazine, and the editor think, well, he's the magazine is smut.
Yes.
It's very sensationalistic. So he doesn't like these fair play whodunits. And I can't help but feel like Mike Barr may be injecting himself in here. He was writing mysteries for Ellery Queen magazine, for example. And he's published. He's also had stories be rejected. Like that first issue with the frames was originally submitted to Ellery Queen magazine. And they rejected it. So he still had it in a drawer and he repurposed it for Maze Agency. I think the play between editor and writer is like, well, this isn't sensationalist enough, is probably biographical in some way. So I like that element. And Jennifer's rival was in this one.
Ashley's in this
one. She's on a page.
She's there and she's at the end too, because she's wrong. One of my notes later on, and she's in five or six different issues, and I'm like, she's never right. How does she earn any money? But she used to be Jennifer's boss. But speaking of repurposing, you might not know, and Shaggy, you wouldn't know because if you don't have the actual issue, on the letters page, which is in the inside back cover, Mike Barr says that the case of the vanishing vehicle Michael first saw the light of day as a proposed episode of Banachek, a 1970s TV series. However, the series got canceled before I could submit the story. Portions of the plot were used in greatly truncated form as an elongated man story I wrote in Detective Comics number 484 from 1980. It was not a very good story, and both pencil Ed Barreto and I have since gotten much better. It's not on DC Universe, unfortunately, 484. I have to dig that one out. I thought that was funny. This was repurposed.
Well, a lot of them are. Actually, one of the nice things is in the trade, he does have those back matters in here. They actually have a page.
Good.
So I do get what's called the backstory on every story. Every single one of these, it does seem like he either wrote it previously and submitted it, like you said, Cisco, to magazines, or he just had the idea. But yeah, it's interesting how often he's bringing back old ideas, because, you know, why throw anything away? It makes sense.
No, exactly.
Absolutely.
I will say, I did actually guess the bad guy in this one.
Wow.
For all the wrong reasons. So I don't count it, because I totally had all the wrong reasons. So I don't count it at all. Anyway, so art-wise, so page 11, first of all, it's beautiful. It's really well done. They've got all these photos of suspects, and they're rendered in penciling, cross-hatching to look to distinguish that these are photographs versus the actual people. Yeah. It's done really well. But the important thing is, this is where the comic book format sings. And if you like Mike W. Barr and Adam Hughes figured out the language of this comic right here, this moment, this page, because this is where you get all the suspects on one page. And so as a reader, you can see all the suspects, you can get their little bio or name or whatever. Throughout, as you're reading, you can always flip back to this page as a guide, as you're trying to solve the mystery. And from this point, starting with issue 3, it will continue on in most issues where they'll have a page where in one way or another, all the suspects are on the same page. And it gives you, as the reader, a hook to look at so you never get confused, you never get lost or whatever. So I love this page because A, artistically, and B, I think they figured out the language of comics at this point.
Yeah, well said.
Good point.
How about 12 and 13? I like those because Gabe is going to drive Jen, and she takes one look at his car and is like, I don't want to drive in that car. And what a motion, the top of 13. She pulls down her sunglasses to look again at the car, and the expression on her face is like, ew.
Right.
I'm telling you, this guy was made to get the job at Justice League America, right?
Oh, yeah. The Kevin Maguire expressions. Absolutely. Yeah.
And look how she's like a coquette when she shows her own car.
Yeah.
She's looking behind her. And he's like, okay, I guess.
Yeah. But it's a fun issue. I don't feel like the ending plays fair, but it's fun to get through and enjoy. Cisco had said earlier, sort of like you enjoy the ride.
All right. Moving on to issue number 4, The Return of Jack the Ripper, a gathering of Ripperologists, which I didn't realize was a thing, but I guess it is.
Oh, yeah.
Is interrupted by a throat slash attack, and followed up by 2 grisly murders. Will Gabe and Jen find the Ripper copycat before he strikes again? The cover, what do you think of this one, Siskoid?
Oh,
this one's more classic in a way. This whole issue has content that may trigger people because they are dealing with the actual Ripper murders, and those are pretty gruesome. Here we have Jen has a flashlight shining it towards us with a nice effect, and she's discovered what appears to be, I mean, if we go with the Ripper thing, a dead hooker splayed in front of us backwards sort of thing. And Gabe is behind. And behind him is the shadow of Jack the Ripper, as if he's a ghost in this thing. So to me, like Ripperologists, I knew were a thing because I read the entire Alan Moore's From Hell.
Oh, okay.
I've never read that. Okay.
So in that particular series had a lot of back matter. Alan Moore was showing his work and notes and notes and notes and notes. So I read that. So I feel like what they say, what Gabe in this issue says, is the actual solution, or the proposed solution that makes the most sense as to who Jack the Ripper really was, is the same conclusion that Alan Moore comes up with, and that many of the more reputed Ripperologists think is the facts of the story. So this was a world I already knew about and understood the different clues that then in the modern story, somebody's using the old Jack the Ripper lore within their crime. So this all seemed very familiar to me.
There's 2 things about the cover I thought were interesting. One is the pearls. I assume they're pearls. I'm looking at the picture black and white.
Yeah,
they're pearls.
Yeah.
Pearls on the ground, you know, in the blood. It's like, okay, wait a minute. This is 1989. Batman, you know, is it, you know, Dark Knight Returns. I'm wondering if there's some imagery there. But unfortunately, as great and awesome as it's illustrated, it does have the sexy victim trope, which probably hadn't been pointed out as a problematic trope in 1989, so I don't know that you can fault them for it. Nowadays, though, we are 2023 goggles on. It's kind of like, I kind of wish maybe she hadn't been sexed up for the death scene, but okay. But great mystery with the Ripperologies. My biggest takeaway from this issue, my absolute biggest takeaway from this issue is I don't want to be friends with Stupid Gabe, because they all either end up dead or falsely accused of murder. So, nope. Sorry, Gabe.
And this is just like a book club he belongs to.
Yeah. Exactly. And now one of the things, too, about the trade that I love is, I told you, I get the cover and I get the backstory, right? But there's also a half-page column of art. It's just cute. It's got sunglasses and a detective's glass and some lipstick and a note and all this stuff. But one of the things that's there is a framed picture, and it's the sketch that the artist does in this issue of Jen. So it's kind of nice to see that Gabe's kept it and it's here. And we do see it again later on the wall of his apartment.
Oh, that's cute. This one has a mystery trope. I thought I'd point out there's a dying message.
Right.
That's in this one as well. From a personal relationship, they're worried about each other because they were part of the Ripperologist Club. So Gabe is staying over at Jen's, but she's like, yeah, no, here's a pile of pillows and blankets. And she pushes him out the door. He's like, whoa. Okay. That was cute. That was cute on page 15. Another good story. Anything you guys want to point out on this one? Just trying to keep moving.
We haven't talked about Bliss very much at all. And she has a good role in this and also good expressions. We see her with chewing gum, not chewing gum, but
bubblegum.
Bubblegum.
Yep, yep.
So she has her own personality as well. She gets sexier later on, but she's often in sweats. What do you think of this relationship between her and the detectives? Because they're always like doing her job, but it doesn't seem contentious in the same way that it does in Sherlock Holmes, for example.
Before we talk about the relationship, I want to talk about Bliss for, because you mentioned her clothes specifically. Like, that's one of the things I have down. I get the sense that through the art, they're trying to tell us something. I think maybe she's supposed to be a bodybuilder because she's often wearing shirts that have gym logos. And later on, like you said, she gets sexier. Inappropriately so. There's ones where she's showing up as the lead police lieutenant in like a cutoff football jersey with an exposed midriff. I'm like, what? Come on. I mean, it's sexy as hell as the reader. I'm like, yeah, thank you. More, please.
But you got her out of bed.
Right. Well, maybe. I don't know. I feel like he's trying to tell us something. You know, again, bodybuilder maybe. As far as her relationship, it's kind of refreshing to see a mystery where it's not, hey, you know, get out of here, you know, detective, get out of this beat. Yeah. So it's kind of nice to see that.
And she's into fitness, apparently, but also a smoker.
She alternates between chewing gum and smoking. So I don't know if she's trying,
maybe she's trying to quit.
I think that's it. And I don't know. Maybe Mike Barr put that in discussions with the artist. Maybe Adam Hughes is just, well, I need to liven this up and gave her those personality traits because they're not referred to.
Right.
So either way, it's just like the relationship that was already ongoing in issue one. She's got a life.
Yeah.
We don't see it. We don't know it, but she's got a life and she feels like a real character.
She does get a spotlight issue later on. I don't know if either one of you guys read that. Number 15, the mystery surrounds her. And
right.
Her
there's someone. Life. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I
read your synopsis.
The one thing that does stick out in this issue, frustrating for me, is this is one of those where I knew who the killer was. I was like, I got it. I see the clues. I am on it. And I was wrong. But it makes for
it wasn't thing. The ghost of Jack the Ripper.
What's that Star Trek episode? Anyway.
Yeah, it wasn't Rojack. Red Jack.
Yeah.
It wasn't Red Jack.
But what that is it's sort of an example of how many red herrings clues there are. Again, I don't want to get into the clues. Maybe off air, I'll tell you guys what they were. But I was so freaking sure I had this one. And I was so proud of myself too. But there's a lot of red herring clues, which is good because that's kind of how real life works. There's all kinds of stuff where like, well, it could be this, could be that. I don't know. And I would also argue that in some of these cases, the red herring clues, if Mike W. Barr had decided to swing the other way and decide that the killer I picked was the killer, I think everyone would just be as, I don't think there's only a couple of occasions where the answer is like only one possible solution works. There's only a few occasions where you can say, okay, there's only one person that could have been the killer. The other ones where there's red herrings, depending on what Mike W. Barr wanted to do, I think he could have switched it and said, oh, it's this other person, and it would have been perfectly acceptable.
All right, anything else on number four?
Don't be friends with Gabe.
All right, number five is one I liked. It's called Death Warmed Over. Everyone's got a motive to, quote, kill the frozen body of the founder of Lazur Cryogenics. Jen and Gabe rush to solve the crime before the temperatures heat up too much. Cover on this one, not my favorite cover, but what do you guys think?
It's much more literal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Our heroes are being threatened in a way that they're not in the story itself, but there's a liquid nitrogen vat being thrown at them. That doesn't happen in the story, of course. It's not an action story in any way, but it is one of the murder weapons, let's say. It's okay. but I don't think it's as clever as the others.
No, they're very small. There's an awful lot of real estate taken up by the liquid nitrogen container. I wasn't my favorite cover.
Yeah.
How about you, Shag?
Everything you guys said. And this one I can actually see in color. It's fine. And that's about it.
What'd you guys think of this story? I found this one interesting. You've got the founder of the company in deep freeze, and there's lots of disagreements between the mother, the son, and the daughter.
Cryogenic freezing was such a big thing in the 80s, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it does make an interesting plot. I love the way the family has sort of gone all in different directions, so that makes them interesting suspects, if you will. I think. Oh, this is the one with the football jersey, by the way, guys. Yeah. So I do like that. And again, you get the opportunity where they lay out who all the suspects are for you. I'm trying to find it, whether they tell us artistically or not. I think it maybe it's just verbally. Yeah, it's just verbally in this one. But you do then meet all the suspects. Anyway, I found it a fun story. I do want to say something real quick artistically, if I can. We don't get a cover page, a splash page on this one, but we do get a great thing that I love when Adam Hughes does this, is he works the title of the issue into the artwork. This issue is probably the best example of it. The first page, the bottom panel, you've got a brick wall that just has the shadows of Mays Agency stretched across it into the distance. And then you've got in the background this giant ice sculpture, essentially, of the words "Death Warmed Over," which is the name of the issue. So I love it when artists do this, and Adam Hughes is so good at this.
Yeah, it's a bit of Will Eisner.
Yeah.
Art points you want to make otherwise in this issue, Shag? I have one or two, but I'm curious if you have any other than the football jersey.
I mean, there's a lot. I do like right out of the gate the perspective shot. You're looking from inside the freezer out at Gabe, and he's got a crowbar and a hammer, and he's about to chip off the ice from this ice maker, right? This ice maker is frozen over. So it's a great perspective, but it's also a nice continuation because the first page has the bad guy with the crowbar.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of continuing a theme there, which is done really well. Now that I can see these in color, I will tell you, Jennifer's even more stunning in color.
Yep.
No question about it.
And there's also some fun art on page 14. Gabe has screwed up. He mentioned he was on a date. You said there were no thought balloons, but you get thought boxes, I guess?
Yeah.
Where he's envisioning himself as a dunce, and then he's envisioning himself shooting himself through the head because he just screws up left and right. So yeah, those are funny. From a story perspective, it's weird. By this point, and maybe this is just the nerd in me who's just got an huge and fatuous crush on Jennifer, but like, it bothers me that they're seeing other people still. I don't want that. I'm like, come on.
It's only issue 5.
Well, yeah, but there's been a whole lot of necking going on. Yeah. Like, maybe I'm just a serial monogamist. I don't know.
Yeah, it's not my usual procedure either, but
Gabe's other date did not go well. And no. Jennifer
is terrible.
Opposite the page you were talking about, when he shows up to the crime scene, he's like, oh, you know, yeah, you've been trying to get me to work for you. And she's like, I can't imagine why I'd want you working for me, Mr. Webb. And the icicles and word balloon again.
Yeah, the word balloon's blue and frozen. Yeah.
She's just giving him a hard time.
Yeah.
Right, I mean, she's teasing him.
They make up.
And it doesn't take much. So I think she was like, oh, yeah. Oh, mm-hmm. But she was doing it as well, yes, right?
She was. Mm-hmm. That's, I think that's why he did it, because he interrupted her date.
Yeah.
But they make up by the end of the story. Spoiler, they do consummate their relationship finally in issue number 6 and become a full-time couple. If you guys didn't read 6, that's the one that had Joe Staten art.
I actually, because of your insistence, I read all 12.
Okay.
Oh, okay. I read the strict minimum, which also includes 8, 9, and 12. I think my favorite bit of humor in this, because there's a lot of humor in this, my favorite bit is the very end where the poster, right? There's a wall with posters on it, cats over there. And this one says, it's Walt Disney's World on Ice with Dorothy Hamill as the poster. But somebody's graffitied over the word world so that it says at the end of a cryogenic story, Walt Disney's on ice.
Yeah. Right, right. Which is great.
So that's fun. You mentioned the freezer. And again, this is a callback to the lady downstairs who screams at him through the floor. Again, very good cat action. The cat's on the fridge. The cat jumps off. I live this every day. So I know this is what cats look like when they're doing those actions. In other words, Adam Hughes, cat lover.
Yeah,
there's no way. And it is a story that has a science fiction angle. So again, a good plot for a comic book version of Mysteries.
Whew. That's it from 1 to 5. There are 3 more Adam Hughes issues. By this point, he had been hired by DC. He had other pieces of stories in the can, but we had Joe Staten on number 6 and Shoemaker.
Greg Shoemaker. Yeah,
that's it. Greg Shoemaker on number 7. And then there's the hiatus. And then it comes back with issues 8 and 9 were by Adam Hughes, and then also, I guess it took him a while to finish up number 12. Any general comments? Through 5 issues, would you have kept buying the series?
Oh, absolutely. Now, Adam Hughes obviously is a huge draw. Huge draw at this point, even regardless that no one knew his name. It's absolutely a huge draw on this, and it's so much fun each month getting absolutely frustrated as hell, picking the wrong killer, giving yourself a complex. Because, I mean, really, I always saw myself as pretty good at detective stories, and clearly I'm wrong. And facing reality sucks. Really is not comfortable. But no, I absolutely would keep buying it. Part of it is the relationship stuff that's going on. That's what I wanted to talk about, is their relationship. And other people may feel differently. I see the seeds of Gabe and Jen in Remington Steele and in Moonlighting. That's where I see that relationship coming from. The little bit of flirtatious in Remington Steele, where the woman was the detective and he was just a pretty face. Now, Gabe's not the pretty face, but, you know, in that one, Laura Holt, which they make a joke about one of these issues, but Laura Holt was the detective. So I feel like there's a little bit of there. There was some will they, won't they in that. And then in Moonlighting, without a doubt, was a major will they, won't they love affair kind of thing. Yep. Where the guy's a schlub, the girl's one of the most beautiful women around, kind of thing. Yep. And Remington Steele was 1982, and Moonlighting was 1985. You guys tell me, do you feel like those were the influence for some of their relationships, or do you feel like it's coming from somewhere else?
For the relationship, I think you're dead on.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
You know, for the characters themselves, I think Jen is very much like those two characters, even absent any relationship. Whereas there is some Ellery Queen in Gabe. Issue 9 is an Ellery Queen special where that character appears along with the heroes. And I think that makes complete sense that you would go and get the rights to do this. And because the character is a composite of, and the story is Ellery Queen is the detective, but he's also credited as the writer of the books, because they're actually written by two people who collaborated and created Ellery Queen as a pseudonym. Okay, so in other words, Gabe, who is a mystery writer, but he's also one of the detectives in these stories, has that DNA. So I think Ellery Queen is part and parcel, part of the DNA of Gabe Webb. But as for her, she's very much like those TV characters, but maybe, I don't know, there's another element in there that I'm not sure that goes beyond Moonlighting and Remington Steele. The secret past.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
it's like something else entirely.
The family dramas and dynamics, fully fleshed out characters. That's the reason I enjoyed it immensely rereading and kept buying it. I think they go from casually dating to being a couple to meeting each other's family to moving in together. And eventually, spoiler, they do get engaged.
Aww.
And issue number 19, it's terrific. It's very satisfying. Sean and I talked a lot in the Batman Family Reunion about the partnership and relationship between Robin and Batgirl. And this is to another level of that. This is real life people developing what feels like a real relationship, and I think it's really terrific.
Yeah. So I read only the Hughes issues. There are 8 in all. I read just those, and I do plan to go back and read the ones that I skipped because the recording date was approaching too fast. Because these are, if we're talking about like big picture things, these are very dense reads. You get all the suspects, the clues unfolding, lots of theories, etc. Lots to read, and then you want to make sure that you're looking at the images, not just because they're pretty or fun, but also because they may contain clues. So I felt like when I read an issue, I'm not ready to read another one right away, you know?
Yeah, they work better at doing one or two at a time. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You're right. Yeah. You use the word dense. That's absolutely the right word to use.
They're very dense. I couldn't get through it. I couldn't read it quick. It's not a quick read.
Mm-hmm.
So I do plan to go back and read the ones I skipped.
It took me a month to read them all. So
okay. Yeah. And I advise when you're reading this, folks, what you should do is read the story. And then as you get to around page, I don't know, 21, 22, you can get a sense for when they're pulling all the suspects together for the reveal. Stop there, go back, reread from the beginning, and then look closer for clues, because you'll really pick. I did that on a couple of times, and I'm like, I'm getting it. You know, when, of course, I was wrong, but you know, at least the interpretation of the clues. I spotted the clues, I just got to interpret them wrong.
Notable stuff in 8 and 9 you guys want to talk about? I mean, in 8, I almost didn't make it to the second half of the story.
There's a pinup there,
and this will definitely go in the gallery. There's a pinup of our three principal female protagonists. They're on the beach. You've got Jennifer in the foreground in a red bikini, Lieutenant Bliss in a one-piece silvery thing, and then Ashley, the tall former boss. And it's just hysterical because Gabe's in the back trying to put together a beach chair and he's choking on it. and then the assistant Lacey's way at the top of the picture saying, hey, there's a body over here.
And that's that's like Vincent Van Gogh in the corner with the hat.
Maybe.
Maybe it is.
I'm not sure, but by this point, it's very slick. He's getting as slick as what seems to be his precursor, in a way, Alan Davis. There's just similarities between the two artists, and now it's getting very much to that level. Like, it always looked good and was fun, but here, not just the pinup, there, everything is...
You do see an improvement. I mean, as good as number one was, by the time he gets to 8 and 9, and it's even better.
And it's worth noting, he inked this himself.
No, it's still Rick Magyar is still...
No, I'm talking about the pinup.
The pinup.
I'm sorry. That's all I'm talking about. I'm sorry. Oh, we're going to talk about the comic. I was just thinking about the pinup because he inked it himself. And if you look at later on, the stuff he does for like Who's Who with the fire pinup, he got famous for doing that fire pinup for the loose leaf Who's Who. Mm-hmm. This is even hotter, folks. I mean, it's just wow. He has arrived without a doubt by this point.
Well, this is more on the level of his Phantom Lady.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, again, for the whole issue. Great expressions. He doesn't mind going a little more cartoony on some characters. This is obviously the Where's the Beef lady playing the...
That is so funny. I didn't know that until the moment you said it.
You're so right. And she's racist. And I mean, like, some of their dialogue is like, I feel a little cringy, but
right.
I guess she deserves her death in the end. But again, there's a lot of humor. It's like, this is the first visit, Jen's first visit to his apartment. And so there's a lot of domestic stuff, them in bed. It's very sexy. And then, of course, there's also a murder to solve. I feel like this one, they're going for something personal, a character that only heard her voice, but a character that's been in the series a few times. It's all part of his world. It's a very personal mystery.
And Gabe is accused of being the murderer.
Yeah, so a trope. Right there, right? It's a mystery trope. Yep. So I really love, this was one of my favorite issues.
I agree. As a package, this was the way to go coming back, the first Innovation issues. I think they pulled off the stop. They got this pin up in there. This was a way to recapture the audience without question.
Now, reading in a series, it works well too, because issue 7, which you didn't read this quite, is a lot about Jen. You learn a lot about Jen's past in that one. And you see, you don't meet all of her family, but you see some family elements.
Oh, this is the one where her family has a drama, etc., right?
Well, no, that's actually after. She goes to a beach house, but it's all her family stuff connected to. Anyway, and you find about her background in a certain covert...
Yeah, and I'm flipping through it, and I see that she's topless at one point. So I see why you liked it.
Okay, it's right there in the name, guys. It's irredeemable. I've never hid this fact. And I've been pretty tame on this episode, I want to say.
And I'm the one who mentioned it, so yeah.
Given how incredibly hot Jennifer Mays is, I've really behaved myself. But yeah, my notes for issue 8, by the way, is just the, in all capital letters, the pinup.
And then we mentioned number 9 real quick. That's the one where we have Ellery Queen come in it. There's a text piece in the actual issue by Mike Barr about why he likes Ellery Queen so much. I'll confess, I had not watched Ellery Queen. I'm sure there are a bunch of like in-jokes and Easter eggs I didn't get.
Probably more from the books, right?
I guess. I haven't read or watched, so I don't know what they were from. And it's not unusual for me not to get stuff, but I didn't get any of that. And this one's not my least favorite, but this was not a favorite one for me, number 9.
Yeah, same here, because I don't even know who Ellery Queen is, other than reading the text piece. Like, literally, the name meant nothing to me. But you can kind of see some of the in-jokes. One of my likes, which is where clearly Simons, who is the beat cop who works with Lieutenant Bliss, he's always there. He's always around. He's got the cigar and he's always, you know, working with him. He's making a bet with clearly the street cop who's from the Ellery stories, and they're making a bet about who's going to solve it first. So that was cute, because even I can interpret and go, oh, I get it. That's my guy, Simons, and their version of Simons. Oh, that's fun.
Yeah, that is cute.
I think they were probably so excited about getting permission to write an Ellery Queen story, which was a big deal, that maybe not all the other pieces were there. I didn't love this one. Although, again, 99% sure I solved this one. My two issues I was sure of was the Ripper one and this one. I was, got it. Yes. And I'm wrong. And it's because I interpret a particular clue the wrong way.
The real solution isn't easy to get. I don't think. I was also on the wrong track.
So then 10 and 11 are not Adam Hughes, although we do get a cover by him on 10, which is a terrific cover. And then you get the Alan Davis cover on the Christmas issue in number 11. And then he comes back with 12, Murderer's Mask. And what'd you guys think of this one?
I like this one. It's got a death mask MacGuffin. And this one has the CIA stuff.
Yeah, this is a get more backstory for Jen. Yeah, I like that.
So she's a lot more than just a private eye. You know, she used to be a secret agent, essentially. So she gets into some action where I'm going, wait a minute. This is more like the Batman or the mystery stuff, right?
Well, in issue 7 was the one where they did tell us she was a CIA.
That she was, yeah.
The cover straight up told us that she was CIA. She apparently got into a lot of action, yeah. So it was very fitting. I didn't even think twice about it. But you're right. Now that you say it, it is sort of like Mike W. Barr leaning on his Batman days, yeah.
There's a sequence that's all in the dark panels, 17, 18, 19 in this issue. They're in the car on a stakeout, and she runs off with the gun to make the switch for the ransom, and another car blows up, and she's running through it, and just some great art with the hair flowing and her going after the bad guys. That's an outstanding sequence. It's like 4 pages long that was really well done.
And that bad guy with the golden tooth is like really creepy.
Yeah.
And you think, well, that's going to be a big clue. It isn't.
Yeah. Well, at least you know it's that guy, though, because every time he reappears, you're like, oh, it's that guy.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's not a clue, but it helps you visualize.
It's part of the storytelling, and yeah. I do like the look of it. But you think, oh, I'm going to look out for anything that points to the killer or the thief having a golden tooth or missing a tooth or something.
Right.
No, it's a hired hand. Okay. And this is the one with Laura Holt, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it is. Yeah,
she goes undercover
as
Gabe's secretary. She's Miss Holt. Laura Holt. Which is, yeah. Where did that name come from, she asks. I'll tell you later. So,
yeah.
Okay, we know the source.
And then wrapping up, you got 13. Does not have Adam Hughes, but it does have a fabulous Adam Hughes cover where Jen is ripping open her shirt like Superman with a Justice Girl costume. And that's the one that they repurposed for the back issue cover. That one, I'm sure, sold some copies. And then you start on the other issues. One that I want to point out, one of my favorites was number 14. And I know you guys didn't read this one. This one was Gabe and Jen were invited to be present at the execution of a convict, but he dies from poisoning beforehand. And there's a prison riot. There's real danger. And I'll just say this, in order to save Jen, Gabe compromises his own moral code. And I just think it's really very clever. And it was one I definitely remembered. So I would recommend 14 as well. And then like I said, 15 is the Lieutenant Bliss spotlight, if you like. Lieutenant
Bliss. Good details. Thanks for sharing.
Anything else you guys want to talk about, or you want to move on to our conclusion? So overall, I think I heard from both of you guys that you liked it and would read more. What do you think about translating to another medium?
Well, as far as seeing more, and I do want to answer that one specifically. Yeah, I absolutely would love to see more. But Adam Hughes' artwork is a big part of the appeal for me. When I read the Joe Staton issue, it was fine. And the story kept me going, but I could definitely feel like something was missing. When I got to the Rob Phipps,
yeah.
His issues, actually, because Rick Magyar inked it, I felt a little of that magic. It wasn't quite as good, but right. So I guess I'm a little bit shallow. Hot, sexy, blonde lady is important to me, I guess. I would like to see more, but it better have really damn good art.
But think about even on your JLI show, you talk about not just Adam Hughes, but Ken McGuire, Ty Templeton. You know, there are people who can provide maybe some of that sexy playfulness, facial expressions. I mean, that's exactly. Really appealing about the book. I agree with that. That is part of the appeal of the book.
Right. And Justice League has been an embarrassment of riches, the amount of amazing artists in Justice League America, until the issues I'm covering right now.
Yeah.
But anyway, so would it translate to another medium was your other question. Here's the thing. Absolutely. It's a whodunit. No brainer. It's not even superheroes. It's a cheap, inexpensive detective show to make. Absolutely. However, I don't know if they made it for TV or a movie. I don't know that it would distinguish itself from any other whodunit TV show or movie. I think, and I enjoyed it. Let me say that. I enjoyed this very, very much. But I think what makes it unique is the comic book format. I think the fact that they're doing this in comic book format is what makes it so special. So while it could translate, I think it's going to lose what makes it unique.
The truth coming out of the mouth of babes, right? Young Shag is right about this.
Jennifer Mays is the babe. Let's get that right.
Yeah, that's true. On TV, this is a dime a dozen. In comics, it's a rarity.
Mm-hmm.
We get a lot of superheroes doing detective work, that sort of stuff. Yes. Sometimes we get a sort of pulp comic, a sort of film noir type, hard-boiled comic. But straight up mysteries, whodunits, they're very difficult to write in the first place.
Right.
So few people could actually pull this off. I think Mike Barr has a particular head for it and love for the subgenre. It works with him. But the fact that we don't get a lot of this, if every second comic series on the stands was a mystery, we might be, well, this is the one where they're kind of a couple. We talk about Who's Who a lot. In Who's Who, you do see some PIs. There's some private detective characters across the series. And they're kind of, what's the difference between Johnny Double and Jason Bard? And there's another one, you know, which is which? In this case, what's the little thing that makes them separate? And it's the couple. It's the dynamic between the characters. And then it's the fact that it wants to be a fair play whodunit, which is very strict. And they pull it off. So I think it is for comics rare. For TV, I mean, they could do it for TV and it would probably be a little successful because there are so many and people watch them and there's like entire channels devoted to this genre. So it's possible, but it would be lost. It's not like it would, I don't know. I mean, if you had the right stars, if you had the right showrunner, et cetera, you could do something, but I think what makes it special is it's a comic.
Yeah, I sort of thought of the same thing. I'd love to see it, but then I think there are lots of different takes on the mystery format on television. And so what really is going to distinguish this? It's really hard to say. I mean, everybody is gorgeous on TV, right? So
right, exactly.
Yeah,
it's a tough one, but it would be neat. So listeners, let us know your thoughts. I will be happy to read comments on a future episode of Batman Family Reunion if people leave comments on this episode. So I'll just go to everybody for closing thoughts on the series. Anything else you want to say? So Siskoid?
I think we said our piece, but I'm certainly, like I said, I'm certainly going to keep reading occasionally, I think like a little mystery from time to time, put them on my tablet so I can just go to them directly to whatever scan. So I will say this as a closing statement. I know I've been harsh on Mike Barr in other podcasts.
You think?
Mostly for comic effect, which is a byproduct of when I made fun of the Outsiders, Batman and the Outsiders first year of issues or so on my blog, and then it just carried over. I'm the guy who hates the Outsiders or thinks the Outsiders are stupid. Much of that is a put on, and then there's some real criticism that is true. I lay that at the feet of Mike Barr, but also at the feet of Jim Aparo, whose art I totally rate. That's just part of my persona. So I've got nothing against Mike Barr, and in fact, I thought this writing here was excellent. And I loved hearing his own voice in the text pages as well and finding out how he put these things together. So I do enjoy him as a writer. So don't take my comments about Outsiders as to mean that I am an anti-Mike Barr. Not at all.
Shag, closing thoughts?
This was an absolute joy. Thanks to Darren and Ruth Sutherland for recommending it to me all those months ago or years ago. And then thank you especially to Michael Crouch, being one of our patrons, and for suggesting we do this, because I'm so glad we did. I've said on the Justice League International Blahaha show that I do, that of all the artists on all the Justice League books that I've covered now over 7 years, Adam Hughes is my favorite. I mean, even more so than Kevin Maguire. Oh. So seeing Adam Hughes's JLA, which makes my heart sing, and now getting a chance to find more Adam Hughes that I'd never seen was awesome. It was so exciting. It was like, I don't know, hanging out inside of joy. I was in the Nexus from Star Trek Generations. It was very happy to read these, and also humbling to get all the mysteries wrong, but I really, really enjoyed it. And absolutely, I'd read more of these. And thank you, Paul, for being our cat wrangler. We really appreciate this.
Well, you never know how it's going to go when you're wrangling cats.
Some cats are harder to wrangle than others.
I spent a month, I read all 23 issues and the two miniseries, which were not as good as the first 23 issue run. I'm pretty sure we talked about the highlight of a lot of these, but I'd recommend any of them. Thanks for, again, the suggestion from Michael Crouch, and thank you guys for being part of it. The game's afoot. Let's head on out there and solve some more mysteries. Thanks, everybody. Have a great night.
The man in this portrait is dead. Who killed him? Was it his bereaved widow?
Welcome to the hour of disenchantment, Mr. Queen.
The family doctor?
He had about 4 months to live.
The business partner?
Well, that rules me out because I was in Albany at the time.
The mysterious priest?
Inspector, I am not going to reveal to you what passed between us.
Or was it someone else? Match wits with Ellery Queen and see if you can guess who done it.